Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing?
I'm well, Nicholas. I'm well. Friday.
Indeed, the best day of the week, and we are approaching that most magical hour, the bit when Friday is ending, but the weekend hasn't begun, and that's the best time of every week. Okay, it is a rather hot day in Cape Town, so I will try to sweat through all of the stories we have today. One thing I do just want to say is apologies for yesterday's episode. I'm not entirely sure what went wrong with my sound. I think I didn't notice that it had switched to the wrong microphone, or there was a connection problem in the wires or something like that. But anyway, the end result was that the audio was pretty much unsalvageable from my end. So I took that episode down. So if you're wondering what happened to yesterday's episode, that's what it is. Apologies for that. We will do our best to make sure it doesn't happen again. Okay, let's get into the news of today. And this is quite interesting. There was an interview between Dr. Mbuyiseni Ndlozi, formerly of the EFF and now of, I don't know, the radio and think tank fame, who was interviewing Secretary General Fikile Mbalula from the ANC. And the conversation, as one would expect, in one with Ndlozi, turned to land redistribution. And Mbalula made some interesting comments. Now, I think the context of these, it's easy to take them out of context, but I will, because he sort of was giving a bit of a long, rambling discussion with Ndlozi, but let me try and explain what he said. So let me just read the exciting bits. If you want to see people running in their numbers out of this country into the United States, redistribute the land, and then this country will turn into rubble. He said this would be the consequence of amending Section 25 of the South African Constitution with its property clause, where the right to private property is sort of protected. However, Mbalula said there will be and there must be land redistribution, and that inevitably whites will still run away from the country. He said when the DA is not there to push back and stop this from happening, they are going to run. They are going to take their money and go. And then he went on to talk about how the consequences of this in Zimbabwe. He said, if a loaf of bread is going to be 500 rand because of redistribution like in Zimbabwe, where will the people of South Africa run to? Zimbabweans are running to South Africa. We've got nowhere to run, no other country to run to. Now, this was the way he framed it. He was kind of, I think, trying to explain to Ndlozi's sort of hardline EFF-ish attitude as to why a aggressive amending of Section 25 of the Constitution can't happen right now, and why the DA had to be inside the GNU for now. He was kind of saying, look, we need to do this land redistribution eventually, but currently the economic power is held by the whites, or, you know, white monopoly capital, whatever, insert your descriptor here. And only once we have sufficiently built up alternatives to this power will be able to engage in the true sort of revolutionary reforms we want to engage in. Still, it's interesting on sort of two levels. One is the fact that he is once again obfuscating the fact that the attempts to change property rights and to change and the passing of the Expropriation Act, which also has expropriation without compensation, are race neutral, actually. They can be used against anyone. So everyone's property rights are actually being destroyed by this, not just, you know, those evil fiendish whites. But the other point is that he's very clearly acknowledging the proper costs of destroying property rights in this argument, which is quite interesting. I don't know, Terence, what do you make of this? This is a little bit difficult to sort of wrap one's head around.
Yeah, well, Mr. Mbalula is not always the most articulate communicator. And in our pre-show discussion, we were chatting about this, and I said, I'm not quite sure what this article is saying. I think that my response to you is, you know, agree with all of the above. Yes, we still intend to do this. No, we're not going to do it now. Yes, it's going to have massive consequences. Yes, we are going to have to accept them one day. You know, for me, what this speaks to is that the ANC has never been a full convert to constitutional democracy. The idea of common citizenship, constitutional governance, and whatever, I think was very much something that that it came to accept as a kind of consolation prize, given the circumstances in the 1990s. I think there were some constitutionalists among it, but I don't think that that's ever been their predominant strain. And secondly, the sort of strain of race nationalism. That for all the ANC's pretensions about being a non-racial organization, I think that's always come with very large qualifiers. So, in that sense, it is a timely reminder of the nature of what is still the largest party in the country. And perhaps in that sense, Mr. Mbalula has done us all a favor by laying it out in such graphic and, if not entirely comprehensible, terminology.
I think he seems to be kind of going back to the ANC's own internal, the way it resolves the fact that it hasn't enacted, you know, full communism, but at the same time is still very, you know, wedded to a lot of those kind of Soviet style ideas from the 80s, it's making a sort of a balance of forces argument. Sure. The impression I got from the discussion was he's basically saying, look, you know, we are not strong enough yet to do this thing, but one day we will be. And then when we will, we can do it. And the costs won't be so bad, you know, because we won't need to rely. We won't be the victim of the bond market. but it is interesting that there's sort of, as a way of kind of explaining why radical actions don't have to be taken, it's quite interesting because the ANC, in terms of, you know, by its own analysis of the country, is that transformation hasn't really happened despite all the transformation policies, and therefore we need more transformation policies to turn the country around. Yeah. It's this sort of completely weird argument that sort of uses the fact that it hasn't been successful to justify more of it. And, you know, I think this kind of just shows how sort of on fumes the ANC is intellectually.
Oh, sure. Look, if you want to understand it being intellectually on fumes, locate politics in 2025 on the question of land ownership. It's completely bizarre. Even in GDP terms, agriculture accounts for about 3% of GDP. Now, disrupt it. I mean, maybe if you want to be generous and spread that through the economy, subsidiary industries, maybe you're up to 10%. There's the export earnings and whatever. So I'm not minimizing. But the point is that's not where the weight of South Africa's economic influence is. It's why people looking for looking to get ahead want a job that pays a steady wage, as opposed to a plot of land. You know, I remember some time ago I saw some interesting satellite footage of territory in what used to be the South Africa's homelands. It's interesting how many of these plots were just not producing anymore, and that's mostly because people, you know, have sort of given up on the on the cultivation option, in part because they've urbanized, they've gone to look for work, in part possibly because social grants have meant that that surviving on an acre of land for some mealies is no longer has the life and death significance it may once have had. But you know, that's the reality. There has been, you know, here's something else. Go back to 1994 you'll notice that that land did not feature in the ANC's election campaign. And somebody asked one of their, somebody I know asked one of their pollsters about this. And he said, because we had daily polls, we knew exactly what people were thinking and it never came up. So, and if you want to see where you go with that, look at the PAC that got half a percentage point. That was their issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, you know, if this is as Mlula also says, you know, when people realize the big mistake they've made and decide to and decide that they betrayed the ANC and will you know, once again penitently go back to it. I think carry on this route and you'll also end up as a half of a Z party.
I think on it's also, you know, part of this is that Mbulula is, you know, trying to sound like a revolutionary because, you know, he wants to win the ANC's internal leadership conference. And that's presumably why he's doing this interview. But I think the most insidious thing he does here is to make the sort of sleight of hand that the ANC has for many years now, which is to describe South Africa's problems as still some sort of great racial conflict. Mm-hmm. On one hand are black people who are poor and oppressed and don't have power. And on the other hand are white people who are, you know, wealthy and cloistered and racist and all turning their mustaches in evilness. But all of these policies, the damage, right? You know, here's the thing. It won't be the quote unquote whites who flee the country if, you know, property rights were completely destroyed in this country by removing it from the constitution and by, you know, passing aggressive legislation and using it and all that. It'll be the middle class. And the middle class consists of people of all races. And your country cannot function particularly well if all of its most skilled professionals and the bulk of much of its tax base disappear overnight. Because it turns out that anyone who owns property will be freaked out and lose value in their property when it, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're a civil servant, whether you're a BE partner at business, whether you're, you know, a teacher, a policeman, a lawyer, whatever. If you suddenly lose all of your house's value because the property market is falling apart, that's going to make it so that if you have the skills and the money, you're going to leave. So I think, once again, this is an ANC sort of electoral tactic. You play up everything as being a racial conflict. Oh, we're gonna take away the property clause of the Constitution because, you know, we want to create racial justice or something like that. But of course, the majority of people who are probably going to have their land or property expropriated by the state will almost inevitably be black, not white. And I think this also, it's a sort of continuing way that the sort of race hustlers and race nationalists distract the country from the real sort of economic struggles here, the attempt to end poverty that the ANC is always engaging in. Anyway, Terence, your final thoughts on this one?
Look, I've been saying this since this issue sort of crawled out of the woodwork a couple of years ago, 2017, actually, no, before that, around about 2000 and 2007. That this is an issue of property rights, not racial distribution. And I've also said that one of the greatest underexplored scandals of the post 1994 dispensation is that land to which black Africans have traditionally had access in those homelands, some of which is fairly high value, you know, KwaZulu, for instance, has very little has been done to extend ownership there, which, you know, I think essentially represents the final victory of the colonial and apartheid mindset. Is that, if, you know, depending on how much melanin you have in your skin, you get a different form of property rights. The ANC has held on to that. In fact, let us not forget that when the original motion on changing the constitution was debated in parliament, then Land Affairs Minister Gugulia Nkwinti said, we are not going to give title. Not going to happen. Off the table. A progressive revolutionary government must own land and make it available to our people. our people don't get to own it. So they might get funny ideas if they don't.
Exactly. And I think that therein lies the reality, is that under these radical land reform proposals, if they were enacted, the sort of EFF, MK, radical ANC versions of these things, the number of black landowners in the country would drop to zero, because there would be none, because the state would control basically everything. And therein lies the path to ruin. It's not the thing is, it's dressed up as sort of racialized communism, when it's actually just kind of communism, which is even worse.
A tidbit for our viewers and listeners: the phrase "white monopoly capital" was not dreamt up by Bell Pottinger. It comes from the South African Communist Party in the 1960s. So,
there you go. Good old SACP enriching our discourse in so many wonderful ways. Okay. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about what we need to actually do to get things working. Jonathan Oppenheimer, I presume, one of the people who the ANC and EFF have in mind when they say white monopoly capital, whose family was very influential in this country, built Anglo-American and De Beers into global mining powerhouses, has said that the South African government needs to get out of the way of entrepreneurs. He says, while small and medium-sized companies make up 91% of formal businesses in South Africa and account for more than a third of GDP, weak economic growth and high running and compliance costs threaten their survival. Oppenheimer said, the most powerful thing the government could do is get out of the way, particularly in the entrepreneurial space. I'm not advocating a completely anarchic libertarian approach by any measure. I truly don't believe that. But the government needs to be very deliberate in understanding that time, particularly for small business, is incredibly precious. So, Terence, I actually want to link this back to the first one. You know, Mbalula says the only way we can empower the black middle class is by these sort of redistributive policies, right? We need BEE, we need this or that. And then he'll also turn around and defend his government's record, which massively overregulates absolutely every kind of business you can possibly think of. And I would say that these two sort of, you know, if you want to empower the black middle class, crippling all small and medium businesses with enormous amounts of red tape and taxes is probably the worst way you can do it. If the ANC wants to find out why the black middle class has not, you know, become the dominant, you know, or has not become, you know, sort of the whole country, and that they no longer need to fear those evil, malevolent whites sitting in the corner turning their mustaches around, it's probably because the ANC has stymied so many efforts in entrepreneurism. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm actually reminded of a conversation I had all the way back in 1993 with a university lecturer who was sort of quite off on the left. I think he used to describe himself as a Trotskyist, but first-class character. And he said, what is the problem with Africa? He said, we don't have a bourgeoisie. We don't have people who create wealth. So we have people who want state positions, who, you know, maybe want to open a bottle store. They don't want to open factories, which I thought was actually quite an interesting take on it. He wasn't saying we don't need factories. I think he was getting it when you go through capitalism first. For a movement so obsessed with Marxist analysis, I think this has simply escaped the ANC. It hasn't entirely escaped the state, in the sense that policy document after policy document, not going back to Mandela's time, but to P.W. Botha's time, has spoken about the burden of excessive regulation and the need to encourage small-scale entrepreneurship. What has been done? Well, nothing, or at least very, very, very little. Now,
On that point, there's this important historical detail that is often, I think, obfuscated in the modern discussion, which is that the apartheid government was also massively over-regulatory. And it wasn't not just through the racial laws, but everything else. You know, even if you were a white business, you had to comply with all sorts of things. I know there were boards for sort of every product. I know there was like a cheese board, for example, and other things which set various arbitrary standards for goods. And That was another thing, I think. And as you say, you know, it was already recognized towards the end of apartheid that this is a bad idea, because that regulation had sort of grown like a moss of everything.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, there's a was a story that was told by Leon Lowe, who was then of the Free Market Foundation. I think this was about Richard Maponya when he died. That in the late 80s, township entrepreneurs would be visited one day by the Department of Trade and Industry, or whatever its current incarnation was. How can we help? The next day, they'd be visited by the you know, the zoning commission, who would confiscate everything. You know, it was this complete theater of the absurd. Or, you know, we want black entrepreneurs, but you know, this is a colored group area, and you know, your pencil doesn't stick quite, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Exactly the same has happened under the ANC, and this, you know, this goes back to warnings that were issued right back in the early years, the Labor Relations Act, the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. I remember the small business discussion document sort of went on about, yeah, you know, small businesses are going to find it difficult to comply with these regulations. But if there's a rate, if there's a increase in aggregate demand, well, you know, then they'll have so much more to sell. You know, that sort of assumes that you have your small business can survive. And, you know, over the last 15 years, South Africa moved into a bring your own infrastructure economy. If you are Astral Foods, you know, a major chicken producer, you literally get a court order to allow you to reticulate your own water. If you are, Celebi's auto body, you probably don't have those sort of, those sort of resources behind you. I think this story fits very well with the one we've just covered. The sort of idea that it's all about, you know, when we reach the appropriate revolutionary moment to seize the land versus, can I actually repair this dented bodywork, or is the electricity going to fail on me? Now I'm going to take a flyer here, but I think it's backed up by, well, just about every piece of evidence that anybody could muster, that the overwhelming majority of South Africans, or however you want to slice that, whether you're talking about, you know, African transgender midgets or whatever, will say, I'm going with option two.
Right. this is an important point, is that people are far less ideological. The ANC, I think, often makes this mistake. I think everyone in the country to some degree at some point has made this mistake of thinking that, you know, the voters in South Africa are like deeply wedded to, you know, whatever idea it might be, whether it's BEE or some other kind of redistributive thing. But the reality is most people just sort of want their lives to be good and stuff to work better. And, you know, they may not always choose the best path to get to those things, but that is what people want. People want jobs. People want no crime. People want clean streets, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, something that sort of, I think it kind of underpins all of this, is that people, if they were presented, I think, with the right options, will pick them in the end. Okay. Last topic for today. We're going to combine sort of three interesting news stories together. The first one is that apparently the former public enterprises minister Molusi Gigaba is, according to the National Prosecuting Authority, going to be appearing in court sometime in the near future. There seemed to be some suggestion it would be today, but that doesn't seem to be happening. It's not clear when he will appear in court as of the last reporting I read. But this is kind of significant. This is in a case with connections, with a corruption case involving Transnet. And one of the reasons that this is important is Melusi Gigaba would be the first sort of person implicated by the Zondo Commission to be, I think, appearing in a sort of major court case relating to that era of things. So that seems good, at least, you know, not the end of the road, but it seems a positive development. At the same time, the former police minister, Senzo Matsunu, said he's cooperating with police in an ongoing investigation and has handed over his personal devices to authorities who are looking into allegations that he is connected to organized crime syndicates. And after being cleared by a SAPS internal disciplinary process, the former bodyguards of Paul Mashatile, the deputy president, who were filmed beating up some off-duty soldiers on the highway, are in court facing charges of assault, and they have failed to have their case dismissed by the court, which has found that there's real evidence that something bad happened here. So, Terence, interesting kind of, you can take these stories together and in two different ways. One is that, what a complete disaster, former ministers in court for corruption, former police minister being investigated by the cops for basically ties to mafias, you know, bodyguards cleared by after beating up members of the public for no good reason, all of that. And yet at the same time, they are all appearing in court, which seems to be a new and positive development. So I don't know, is the South African state actually moving in the right direction?
Well, for me, the first thing that springs to mind is this is an illustration of just how broken South Africa's social contract is. When people whose job is to protect the deputy president decide to stop off for some recreational assault and battery, you know, of guys who have, you know, who pose no realistic threat, that says something about the pathologies in this country. And I must say, I was quite happy to see the photographs in the Daily Maverick piece, the one that showed them all standing in the dock looking somewhat perturbed, and the other where they're trying to hide their faces. And yes, you know, you behave in this way, you should be ashamed. Shame is a commodity and an emotion in very short supply, sadly. On the other hand, you're quite correct. This sort of thing has gone, these sort of things have gone on unchecked for years and years and years. And I reiterate, this is not a Zuma thing. In as much as we should be concerned that the now suspended Minister of Police has been fingered in this way, and remains to be seen exactly what the evidence for this is. We had a police commissioner who was consorting with gentlemen of very dubious integrity, and a president at the time, not Jacob Zuma, spoiler alert, who said, "Trust me on this." We've had abusive blue light convoys. I think there was a case where one literally shot, you know, fired a firearm and blew out the tire of a motorist that hadn't shown sufficient fear, trembling, and obeisance to authority. And yes, the Zondo Commission is a very weighty, well, a collection of very weighty tomes, and I think R1 billion in expenses. And one hopes that even though he has not appeared in court, because the wheels of justice don't so much turn slowly as turn imperceptibly, it's good that there appears to be some sort of turning. This doesn't happen for everyone. You know, you can ask the people who were named in connection with the assassination of Obita Diokaran. So would I counsel anybody to, you know, to pop the champagne corks, not just because it's Friday afternoon, but because, you know, the worm is finally turning? No, I think the worm is still eating the apple, but, you know, perhaps there is some appetite to at least be seen to be doing something.
Right. I for me, this is just proof that despite all of the very many problems we have in South Africa, that there are parts of the state and the system that are still trying to sort of turn over and do their things, and yeah. The judiciary is one of those, which is you know, you can have your criticisms of it, but for the most part, I think it has managed to hold up reasonably well. And this is one of the great benefits of having a proper legal system, is that at the end of the day, judges, doesn't matter if they're political appointees or whatever, very quickly, I think there was a comment from a national party.
Oswald Pirro, the one you're thinking about.
Yeah, who complained that, you know, you appoint a judge to be your minion in the judiciary, and within about 2 months, he thinks he's gotten there entirely on his own merits and starts acting independently and doing whatever he thinks is best. And I think that this is one of the great arguments for having separation of powers and an independent judiciary is that it can do bad things sometimes, but it can also hold as a sort of useful part of the state that is a bit immune to some of these corrupting things. And I think that's something we have to be thankful for. There's many countries in Africa and indeed the world where they do not have anything like an independent judiciary at all. And those countries, by and large, are much worse places to live.
That's absolutely correct. And I think, you know, another thing, I think this maybe appeals to my more vindictive side. I really appreciate the fact that the magistrate said, no, you can't wear your face masks. Take them off. It's easy.
Yeah.
Come out and face the population whose trust you are believed to have abused, and which video, you know, you certainly weren't showing any that sort of restraint when it came to, you know, clubbing people who were lying prostrate on the ground. So yes,
especially after the farce of the internal disciplinary process in SAPS.
Yeah, program, absolutely.
Which is just
wrong. But let's just conclude on a sobering note. You remember the tragic and by South African standards celebrated case of Collins Chobani, the man who was clubbed to death by two soldiers in his yard for the sin of drinking a beer during lockdown, which was not illegal, and turned out they'd done this because he hadn't shown them the correct respect. We have never learned the names of those people, and as far as can be as I can establish, and I've checked on it regularly, they have never been punished for it.
Yeah. But that remains one of the most shocking incidences of state abuse actually in our recent history, and as you say, it has not been properly interrogated. I think you said Collins Chobani was Collins Khoza, wasn't it?
Collins Khoza, sorry, yes. Once again, we cycle back, and even names that we should remember, they start to blur.
Yeah, no, exactly. Okay, well, sorry about the sound yesterday on the show. I would just like to draw your attention, if you haven't seen it in the news, to the story of what's going on inside MK and the former chief whip of of MK, Des van Rooyen, who was once the former finance minister of the country for just one weekend, earning himself the nickname the Weekend Special. He didn't last even a day in the position as chief whip of MK, and so he's been demoted, I think, to the Daily Special, which that entire story with Zuma and MK's internal politics is some hilarious stuff. So do go read about that if you're interested. But anyway, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow. On Monday, on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone. Have a great day.